Well, as mentioned, Brother Peter Kravis will serve us this morning, and he is selected for his topic, Hebrews Part 2. Hebrews Part 2.
Good morning, brethren. A couple of years ago, we spoke on the topic of an introduction to the book of Hebrews. This is Part 2, but since that discourse, we gave a couple of discourses on the covenants and how the church ties into the covenants. And that was in part really a continuation of the discussion in Hebrews, because there were a number of parts of that that were from Hebrews. And some of what we're going to touch on today touches on the covenants, because we didn't quite finish up that discussion. So we're not sure how far we're going to get. But there's some overlap between Hebrews and the covenants. But this is our part two. Now, regarding tabernacle shadows, we think it was providential that this was the first book in that came out with the Studies in the Scriptures series for the brethren to look at, because it really gave, right from the get-go, it really gave the brethren some keen insight into the concept of consecration. And in the preface to Tabernacle Shadows, we read the following. This first edition of this little book was published in 1881, and under the Lord's blessing seemed to have been very helpful to the class for which it was specially intended, the royal priesthood. Many of this class have confessed that as the finger of the Lord, it pointed out to them the meanings in the Old Testament types never before appreciated, and it has thus guided them in the way of self-sacrifice by leading them to see the true significance of Scripture declarations. Present your bodies a living sacrifice. Fill up that which is lacking in the afflictions of Christ. If you suffer with him, you will reign with him. Let us go without the camp bearing his reproach. Besides many other scripture statements which associate the Lord's people with himself, both in his sufferings of the present time and the glory to follow. And that's a good introduction for our discussion today. Let's start with this question from Hebrews. How do we know the tabernacle and the law covenant were types or typical? Now, you've been studying the tabernacle recently here on Sunday. So you know the answer. Many of these concepts supported in the tabernacle come from the book of Hebrews. And Paul taught that the tabernacle, Aaronic priesthood, and the law covenant were all typical or a copy or shadow of heavenly things. In Hebrews 8, verse 5, and we're going to be spending most of our time, of course, in the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews 8, verse 5, it says, we read that, we read about the tabernacle there, and it says, it is a copy and shadow of the heavenly things, even as Moses is warned of God when he is about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern that was shown thee in the mount. So, clearly, he's saying the tabernacle is a copy. It's a shadow. In Hebrews 10:1, for the law, having a shadow of good things to come, not the very image of the things, can never with the same sacrifices year by year, which they continually offer, make perfect them that draw nigh. So again, a shadow of good things to come. So, the Apostle Paul in the book of Hebrews is doing more than just drawing lessons. He's drawing direct type, anti-type applications of the priesthood, the tabernacle, and the law covenant relating to the new covenant. Okay, let's go on to another question. Why does the high priest offer a sacrifice for himself? Antitypically, how does this make any sense, that the high priest offers a sacrifice for himself? Jesus was sinless. He did not need to offer a sacrifice for himself, and yet the priest did this in the type. Aaron did this in the type. The high priest did this. Is the type flawed? Let's look at Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. This is the New American Standard Version. It says this: For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself is also beset with weaknesses. Does that sound like Jesus? That's how it was in the type. The priest was beset with weaknesses. In verse 3, and because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins, as for the people, so also for himself. So because the high priest had weaknesses and was a sinner, he had to offer sacrifices for himself. How do we make sense of this in an antitypical application? How can we apply this to Christ? We know that Jesus is sinless. There's so many scriptures on that. Let's just look at some from Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15 says, And we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things, yet without sin. Jesus was sinless. Hebrews 7:26, For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separate from sinners, exalted above the heavens. So Jesus was sinless. Why then did he need to offer a sacrifice for himself antitypically? Let's look for an answer. Let's go back to the Old Testament. Leviticus 16 talks about the Day of Atonement sacrifices. Remember, with the bullock and the goat, this was offered once a year. And in Leviticus chapter 16, verse 6, we read, Then Aaron shall offer the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, that he may make atonement for himself and his household. So the expression himself, here in Leviticus 16:6, that expression applies to more than just Aaron himself. It applies to his household. So when Aaron sacrificed the bullock, he was doing it for more than just himself personally. He was also doing it for his household. Although Jesus has no sins, his body members are sinners. This is how Jesus sacrifices the bullock for himself. In Hebrews, the expression himself often refers to Jesus' body members. And it's important to keep that in mind, because that's the only way to make sense out of this concept. And so there are times when people read himself in Hebrews when it's referring to more than Jesus personally, but they, in their minds, when they read the scriptures, they're thinking it applies to Jesus personally. So that's why we have to look at the book carefully to find out which way it should go, because if it applies to us, And then we need to know that so that we know what to do about it. Now, not only is this true of Aaron and his household, that the expression himself refers to Aaron and his household, but this is also true of the animals, that in Hebrews, sometimes when himself is used, it's referring to the bullock and the goat. Two sacrifices, one body. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 7, verse 27. Who does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins, and then for the sins of the people, because this he did once when he offered up the bullock and the goat, when he offered up himself. Himself was pictured by the bullock and the goat. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest offered both the bullock and the goat. Now, we're not going to go to Hebrews 13 now, but we know from Hebrews 13 where it says, let us go without the camp, just like he did, that what did go without the camp was the bullock and the goat. And that shows us that the bullock applies to Jesus and the goat applies to the church. Therefore, himself in Hebrews 7:27 represents both the perfect humanity of Jesus, the bullock, and the justified humanity of the goat. Now remember, the priest represents the new creature, the new creature of Jesus, and the underpriest, the new creature of the church. The animals represent the flesh that's sacrificed, the justified flesh of the church, the perfect human flesh of Jesus. So this answers our question. This is how Jesus could offer a sacrifice for himself, because himself includes Jesus' body members. This is true whether himself is referring to the high priest and his household or referring to the bullock and the goat. In both cases, himself includes Jesus and his body members. Where can we find further confirmation that this expression, himself, represents Jesus' body members? Well, you know, there's a similar concept outside of Hebrews. In Galatians 3:16, it says this, Galatians 3:16, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to seeds, as to referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. Now, when you read this, it's very easy to apply this text to only Jesus. It sure sounds like that on the surface, doesn't it? Paul even makes the point that he does not say seeds referring to many, but to one, to Christ. Wow, that sounds like Jesus Christ alone. But you know, we learn in, remember the expression Christ is used here. We learn in 1 Corinthians 12:12, for even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is Christ. Christ, meaning anointed, is made up of many anointed members. Now, we get confirmation of this application of Galatians 3:16, that it's not referring to Jesus alone, but his body members. When we go back to Galatians 3, and just a few verses later, in verse 29, it says, if ye be Christ, then are you Abraham's seed, and heirs according to the promise. So sometimes we can look at scriptures that talk about Christ and we think, oh, that's just Jesus. But we've got to be careful and look at the context, because Christ is made up of many members. And sometimes maybe it does refer to only Jesus, but sometimes the passage is including his body members. Now, we find this word himself in Hebrews 9:7. So I'm going to read for context verses 6 and verses 7 of Hebrews 9. Now, when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. Again, the word himself must include Jesus' body members. These verses are talking about the annual Day of Atonement sacrifices. The bullock was not sacrificed for Jesus' sins. He had no sins. The bullock was sacrificed for his body members. Okay, so again, himself in Hebrews refers to more than just Jesus. It includes his body members. This brings us to what was, at least for me personally, this was the most difficult area of Hebrews, because 25 years ago or so, I started looking at Hebrews closely because I was involved in friendly debates on whether or not the church was ratifying the new covenant or under the new covenant, whether the church had the share in the sin offering or not. So in trying to make sense of the whole book of Hebrews and seeing this concept of himself, I got stuck on Hebrews 9, 25 and 26. So let's take a look at this. Do these verses disprove that the expression himself includes Jesus' body members? So remember, this is the toughest obstacle. So if we're wrong on this application of himself, this is what shows it. Can we answer this? Let's look at it. Hebrews 9, verses 25 and 26. Nor was it that he would offer himself often as the high priest enters the holy place once a year with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, he would not have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sins by the sacrifice of himself. Now, one possibility is that, well, the word himself doesn't always refer to Jesus and his body members. Sometimes it refers to just Jesus alone. And that's possible. But we're going to suggest that even here, it includes the broader picture. Let me elaborate. What Paul is doing here, he's creating the hypothetical argument that if the reality had been like the type, then Jesus would have had to offer himself in sacrifice annually every year since the foundation of the world. Now, since the church began at Pentecost, then Jesus' body members could not have been included in that hypothetical scenario. But we offer this response. Again, Paul is making a hypothetical argument which doesn't represent reality. Although the church did not begin till Pentecost, Christ's ministry didn't begin until 3.5 years earlier, at his baptism in AD 29. So neither Jesus nor his body members were available centuries earlier to be offered up as sacrifices from the foundation of the world. And the only way that could have worked out is if there had been a major alteration made in God's plan. But we're not going to talk anymore about hypothetical alterations of God's plans. Now notice, verse 26 says, "Now once, at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifest to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." How did Jesus put away sin by the sacrifice of himself? A side point. We are not reading a ransom text. This is a sin offering text. It's not about the cross. It's about Jordan and Pentecost. Jesus as the bullock was offered up at Jordan when he was baptized. It took 3.5 years for him to complete that sacrifice. The church was offered up at Pentecost. It has taken nearly 2,000 years, and that sacrifice is not yet complete. So, how did Jesus put away sin? It says he put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. How did Jesus put away sin? The word "put away" is from Strong's 115. According to the online Bible Greek lexicon, it means abolition, disannulling, put away, rejection. The Greek word is used only one other time in the Bible. There's only one other place this word's used. Let's see how Paul uses it earlier in Hebrews, because that's the only other place it's used, and let's see if it can help us to interpret Hebrews 9:26. Hebrews 7:18 says this, "For on the one hand, there is a setting aside," Strong's 115, "a setting aside of the former commandment because of its weaknesses and uselessness. For the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope, which we draw near." What's being set aside here? It's the former commandment, the law covenant. That's what, when Paul uses this Strong's word, 115, he's talking about setting aside this law covenant and the things associated with it, like the former priesthood. As a matter of fact, in that context, just a few verses earlier, Paul says in Hebrews 7:12, "For when the priesthood is changed, there of necessity takes place a change in the law." So both the law covenant and its priesthood are now being changed and set aside. So the law covenant and the priesthood, the old one is what's being set aside. There's a new priesthood being developed, which will be administering a new covenant. What is being set aside in Hebrews 9:26? Again, it is the law covenant that is put away. But wait, Hebrews 9:26, "to put away sin," not the law, "to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself." It says sin, not priesthood or law covenant. Why am I saying that Hebrews 9:26 is talking about putting away the priesthood and the law covenant? Some of you may know the answer or remember. You know that the Greek word for sin, Strong's 266, can sometimes refer to sin offering, if the context supports it. Thayer's Greek lexicon points to support from the Septuagint, where, for example, the Greek word is translated sin offering in Leviticus 5:11 and 7:37. Now, there's other examples we can show, and I don't know if we'll have time to get into it. It's later. where we talk about the word sin and how it's used in Hebrews, where sometimes it refers to sin offering and sometimes to sin itself. It could go either way, and the context needs to interpret that. So, in other words, here's what we're saying. Remember, our initial question was, how does Jesus put away sin by the sacrifice of himself? And it was based on Hebrews 9, 25, and 26. In other words, what we're saying is, by the sacrifice of himself, Christ and his body members, the old law covenant sin offering and its priesthood are being put away and replaced by a new sin offering sacrifice, which will be complete when Jesus is revealed to the world. Do we find further support for this? What further support do we find that the sin offering ends when Christ is revealed to the world? All right. Hebrews 9:28. The last part of the verse says, shall appear a second time apart from sin offering to them that are waiting, that wait for him unto salvation. So when Jesus' second advent is revealed to the world, it will be apart from sin offering. In other words, the sin offering will have been completed. You see, that's what this verse means. The sin offering needs to be completed before the new covenant can go into operation, the kingdom can come, and all the families of the earth can be blessed. So the passage says, apart from sin offering, to them that wait for him to salvation, that's when he'll appear a second time, when the sin offering is done. It has to be completed first. Notice it says, unto salvation. Once the sin offering is complete, the groaning creation can be saved out of their dying and sinful condition. Now, the word appear is from Strong's 3708. Now, that's where it says, he shall appear a second time. That's from Strong's 3708. It's the same word translated seeing in Hebrews 11:27. By faith, he, Moses, forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So Moses saw Jehovah by faith. And in Hebrews 9, when it says, he shall appear a second time, that's when the world will see Jesus at a second advent by faith. Now let's look at the beginning of Hebrews 9:28. We read the second half. Let's read the first half. The first half of Hebrews 9:28 says, so Christ was offered, Strong's 4374, to bear, Strong's 399, the sins of many. So Christ was offered to bear the sins of many. Now, this word bear, it's possible that that word can be translated offer up. The word has both meanings, can either mean bear or offer up. There are two words translated offer in the book of Hebrews. Both words are found here. So it says, so it's when it says, so Christ was offered, that's the first time, Strong's 4374, to bear the sins of many. That word bear, Strong's 399, that's another word that's often translated offer. So the two Greek words translated offer in the book of Hebrews refer to the offering of sacrifice. And I have a list of a number of texts where this is used, including James 2:21. In 1 Peter 2:5, where it's talking about offering up as an offering up sacrifice. But that word is also used two other times in Hebrews. Okay, now we're talking about the word bear, Strong's 399. So it says, so Christ was offered to bear. That word bear, Strong's 399, is used two other times in Hebrews. How is it used in Hebrews the two other times? Is it translated bear or offer? It's translated offer both times. Hebrews 7:27 says, who needeth not daily like those high priests to offer up sacrifice, that's the word bear. It's translated offer up sacrifice, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. For this he did once when he offered up himself. In Hebrews 13:15, the second place, by him, therefore, let us offer up the sacrifice of praise to God, etc. So, perhaps, Hebrews 9:28 might be better translated this way. And this is our suggestion. Here's how we would translate Hebrews 9:28. So, the Christ was offered to offer up the sin offering for many, shall appear a second time for salvation without any more sin offering to those who eagerly await for him. If only the translators understood tabernacle shadows, the church's share in the sin offering, and ratifying the new covenant, it wouldn't be so confusing to try to sort through this and figure it all out. We're thankful that Brother Russell and many Bible students since then have done so much study here, and we're living at an age and a time now where we can bring up our Bible on the computer and we can highlight a Strong's number and do a search and instantly see every time it's listed. If this was 20 or 30 years ago, it would be very difficult for me to grab Strong's and grab Englishman's and have to look up all these tie-ins and how these words are used. But it's in these times of restitution we're living in with all this increase of knowledge, there's so much that we can have at our fingertips so much quicker, which we need because we're all so busy, aren't we? Hustle and bustle of life. Okay. Now, Hebrews 10:18 is making the similar point about the fact that the sin offering needs to end first before Christ is revealed to the world and the new covenant goes into operation. First, the new covenant has to be completed. In Hebrews 10:18, we read, where remission of these is, there is no more offering for sins, or no more sin offering. Now, to get the context, the previous verse is talking about the Lord no more remembering the sins under the new covenant. When that happens, you know the sin offering sacrifice is completed. When the world's under the new covenant and their sins aren't being remembered anymore, the ransom and the sin offering are being put into effect, where remission of these is, there's no more offering for sin. The sin offerings come to a conclusion. Now, does the immediate context in Hebrews 9, verses 25 and 26 support that, again, himself is Christ's head and body? Let's go just a few verses earlier, a couple of verses earlier, in Hebrews 9, 22 and 23. And according to the law, I may almost say all things are cleansed with blood, and apart from the shedding of blood, there is no remission. It was necessary, therefore, that the copies of the things in the heavens should be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things with better sacrifices than these. Not a better sacrifice, but better sacrifices, plural. The heavenly things are the antitype of the law covenant types and the tabernacle types. The better sacrifices are in the plural, showing the sacrifice being spoken of here is both Christ, head and body. So everything about the context helps support this, and even in the most, what will suggest is the most difficult area of Hebrews to make an application of the word himself apply to Christ and his body members, even there it makes sense to do that. Now, I know there's too much detail to remember it all, so as always, we make the text of our presentations available to anyone who wants to review the evidence. How is the church sanctified? Hebrews chapter 10 talks about how the church is sanctified. And we want to get context to build up to that point. First of all, Hebrews 10, verses 1 through 4. Let's read that together. Hebrews 10, verses 1 through 4. And remember, we're leading up to how is the church sanctified. Hebrews 10, verses 1 through 4 says, "For the law, since it has only a shadow of good things to come and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices, year by year, which they offer continually, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, they would not have ceased to be offered because the worshipers, ceased to be offered because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins." So, in other words, what that's saying is that the law could not perfect the character and conscience of sinners. Otherwise, the Jewish sin offering would not have been needed to be offered year by year. In other words, if it was successful, if these sacrifices were really successful in removing sin and making the worshipers perfect, they wouldn't have had to continue to be offered. Then reading on, verse 5, "Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, 'Sacrifice and offering thou hast not desired, but a body hast thou prepared for me. And whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin thou hast taken no pleasure.' Then I said, 'Behold, I have come, and the roll of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God.'" Verse 8, "After saying sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law." In verse 9, "Then he said, 'Behold, I have come to do your will.'" He takes away the first that he may establish the second. Now, these verses are showing that Jesus can remove sins. As the antitypical bullock, he says, "I come to do your will." So that's in verses 7 and 9. Jesus says, "I come to do your will." In verse 9, the second is Christ in the church, replaces the first, the bullock and the goat. Now, let's look closely at verse 10. Verse 10 is very important. It relates to us. By this will, remember Jesus said, I come to do thy will? Verse 10, it's saying, by this will, we have been sanctified. We've been sanctified, not justified. We've been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus once for all. By this will means that Jesus' body members are joining in with him. Jesus says, I come to do thy will. As his body members, we join with him in that sacrifice. We too say, I come to do thy will. And hence it says here in verse 10, by this will we have been sanctified. As the antitypical goat, the church says together with Christ, I come to do thy will. This principle of joint sacrifice is established early in Hebrews and throughout Hebrews. We remember way back in chapter 2, near the beginning of Hebrews, verse 11, it says, for both he who sanctifies and those who sanctify are all from one Father, for which reason he's not ashamed to call them brethren. That word father is added. It's not in the Greek at all. And some of your translations, you may see it in italics. The text should read, are all of one. Yes, the church is offered up together as part of the Christ head and body. We are all of one. That is, all of one body, we say together, I come to do thy will. The offering of the body must include the church, since it is our offering that of our bodies and sacrifice, Romans 12:1, that has this sanctifying effect on our lives. So what we're saying here is that by this will we've been sanctified by the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. This is not talking about Jesus' personal body alone being sacrificed, because Jesus' ransom sacrifice justifies us. Jesus' ransom sacrifice does not sanctify us. Sanctification is a process of development, growth, being made holy, being made Christ-like. We're told in Hebrews 5:9 of Jesus, he was perfected by the things which he suffered. And this word perfect, as it's used in Hebrews, is talking about the development of Christian character. Now, Hebrews 10:14 goes on to say, by one offering, he's perfected for all time those who are sanctified. So this one corporate offering of Christ and the church, this whole offering up of the body, perfects our character and sanctifies the church, just as Jesus' character was perfected through his own sufferings. And that's in Hebrews 2:10 and 5, 8, and 9. And you know, this word perfect, we could spend a long time talking about how to do a search on this Strong's word for perfect and how it's used throughout Hebrews. You know, remember in Hebrews 6:1 where it says, leaving the elementary teachings about Christ, let us press on to maturity? That's the same form of the Greek word perfect. So it's talking about us moving on to perfection or Christian development or Christian maturity. And so when it says, for by one offering he's perfected her, he's matured us, he's helped us to grow, all those who are sanctified. So this offering up of the body of Christ has this process of sanctification and perfecting of our characters. Does Hebrews 10 show us when the new covenant is made? We've already talked about this a little bit, but there's more. In Hebrews 10, 15 to 18, most translators really ruin this because they have no, again, understanding of the sin offering or the church ratifying the new covenant and joint sacrifice with Christ. The word after is very important here. We find the word after used in verse 15, and we think it's referring to the word after in the Jeremiah 31 prophecy. So he's talking about after, and then he talks about the new covenant. So the new covenant comes after something. Okay, and again, this word after is in Hebrews 9:15. Well, you know, Paul quotes this Jeremiah 31 prophecy in Hebrews 8. And pointing out in verses 8 and 9 that the new covenant comes after Israel's period of disfavor, when he favored them not. So, this period of disfavor begins in AD 33 when Jesus said, "Your house is left unto you desolate." And some brethren have also thought that the word after could be referring to verse 14. So in Hebrews 10, if we look at verse 14, where it says, "For by one offering he is perfected for all time those who are sanctified," then the Holy Spirit witnesses, "For after then comes a new covenant." Some brethren have looked at this and thought, well, what this means is that in verse 14 it talks about the body of Christ being developed during the gospel age. Then after that, the new covenant would go into effect. And then others have thought, and I think this may be the better point of view, or though either one makes sense, that it's talking about after in Hebrews 8, where after those days. Okay. After those days of disfavor, he'll make a new covenant with them. Does Hebrews 8 show us when the new covenant is made? In Hebrews 8, Paul says that the main point is that Jesus is our high priest. That's in Hebrews 8:1. So Paul's saying that the main point in all these chapters we've been leading up to is that Jesus is our high priest. In contrast, he found fault with them, the Levitical priesthood. That's in Hebrews 8:8. Hebrews 8:8 says, "Behold, the days are cometh, saith the Lord, when I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." I don't have the right verse here. What's that? I do. "Not like the covenant when I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and I did not care for them, says the Lord. For this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days." Okay. That was just a couple of verses earlier. But anyway, he did find fault with them, and he did not care for them. But after those days, he's going to make a new covenant. And again, we think that's the point Paul may be driving back to in Hebrews 9:15. Because he found fault with the first priesthood, he says, I will make a new covenant after those days, verse 10 of Hebrews 8. After the days of verse 9 when he says, I did not care for them. The new covenant could not have begun at the time of the Apostle Paul, since it was to begin after the days that he did not care for them, during Israel's period of disfavor spanning the gospel age. Now, in Hebrews 8:13, and we're going to wrap up now. In Hebrews 8:13, it says, in that he saith the new covenant, he makes the first old. Now that which is decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. So since in Paul's day the old covenant had not yet vanished away, the new covenant could not have yet been established. So he says it's ready to vanish away. It's not gone yet. You even remember when we were talking about in Galatians when cast out the bondwoman and her son, when Israel was cast out, the bondwoman went with her. So the law covenants in the dying and decaying condition, there are new sacrifices already replacing it, antitypical ones, and that old covenant is dying out. But the shadow and type ends when the reality begins, and the law covenant is a shadow of things to come. So when the law covenant has fully passed away, it's been passing away for the past 2,000 years, when it fully passes away, the new covenant can go into operation. Now, if we had time, what we'd point out is that, you know, in Hebrews 12, when it says we've approached Mount Zion, well, it's contrasting when the Jews approached Mount Sinai, and God gave them the law covenant. So some brethren have looked at this and said, well, since we've arrived at Mount Zion, that means we've arrived at the new covenant. But if we had time, we'd go into, I think we'd put you to sleep, some pages of evidence that indicate that this word probably means approaching, that we're approaching and we've been approaching Mount Zion throughout the gospel age. Not that we've arrived. But hypothetically, even if, see how many pages I'm flipping, there's a lot on this. Hypothetically, even if we had arrived at Mount Zion, when you look back at the picture in Exodus 19, when they arrived at Mount Sinai and God's voice was booming and he started reciting the Ten Commandments, it wasn't until several chapters later, in chapter 24, that Moses had gone up and down the mountain a couple of times, that the law covenant was actually ratified by animal sacrifices in Exodus 24. And it was at that time that Moses read the law in Exodus 24 to the people, and he said, will you do all these things? And for the second time, they said, yes, we'll do all these things. But this was the first time they had actually had the law read to them. So hypothetically, even if we have arrived at Mount Zion, and I don't think that's correct. I think we're approaching Mount Zion. But even if we had arrived, that would not prove that we're under the new covenant. And so with that, we don't want to go over time. We hope these thoughts have been a blessing. And hopefully I won't have a Hebrews part 3. Because this is getting to be a lot on Hebrews.